Les colloques du Collège de France.
Our second speaker is Dagmar Riedel. She worked for the Center for Iranian Studies, and he was an assistant editor until April 2010, and then as associate editor of the Encyclopedia Iranica. And now she is the chair of Columbia University Seminar on Religion and Writing, and she is affiliated with Columbia University.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the invitation. And this will be much more a report about a project that is ongoing. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to present it here. You will see between our projects, just between Sarah's and mine, that I, for instance, don't have, despite the fact that my figures are more than 200 years later, I don't have, for instance, the archival documents going with this, because Nizaman left archives. I also don't have the library documentation, so I'm working actually backwards. I'm working from the books themselves and trying to contextualize those. So just before you get a lot of other things that are less pleasing, I wanted to show the two gentlemen to you. So these are the brothers, William and Gore Ousley. They are nowadays primarily associated with very beautiful manuscripts that have become focus of art historical study. And you will see Ousley material cited all over the place, but we have almost, because we are primarily interested in how this material generates within the Islamic world. So the way of its transition from the Islamic world into the European collections is also because we have ethical issues, is much less discussed. So this is just an incredibly important Timurid Shahnameh. And this is this belonged to Gore, and this one belonged to William, which is also a Shahnameh. Both are complete text. You find them in the Cambridge Shahnameh project. And these digital images were courtesy of Columbia. Just to give you a survey of what they left behind, or what they didn't leave us with. And one of the challenges of the project is that even though the Bodleian has this material cataloged, we are dealing with a library of more than 400 years old that is still in operation. And at the same time, because of how Oxford operates, to some degree the Bodleian is the repository of the college libraries that discharge what they don't want to keep to the Bodleian. So the Bodleian accumulates discharge material from college libraries while at the same time having its own collections. And like every old working library, occasionally you have something named a collection, but nonetheless you have editions that are actually not part of the same collection, but receive the shelf marks. And that is in particular the problem with regard to the Ousley ad. Not everything that has an Ousley ad shelf mark is actually a Ousley manuscript. And we cannot necessarily have, we don't have safe, we have no, I cannot go to an acquisition book. All I have are acquisition numbers, and I have some summaries of acquisitions, but I don't have anything coming close in its documentary detail to what Sarah had. So we're having about 1,000 manuscripts, roughly, take it or leave it, in the Bodleian. We have, and this is the material that comes next, particularly in the Rylands, is due to also the work of Jake Benson in the Rylands primarily, who has found in part with, in connection with recataloging the Persian manuscripts online, found manuscripts that he thought came from Gore, and then opened up the whole question of how did we get this material, actually. And then we have both brothers, basically also, of course, like many Georgian-era collectors, collected not only books, they collected other objects as well, and both sold and gave this material to the British Museum. So if in some ways, if you talk about their books, we have to see the books also in part of actually larger collections that do usually also include artifacts. And then the fact that I had as the last line, there are no dedicated archives for either brother. I benefited very much from the fact that the Bodleian after World War II had at a certain point enough money to very detailed cataloged its letter collections. And I have there very detailed and indices for the letter collections. So I could find dispersed letters by the Ousley brothers across collections. And they only survive because both brothers have nowadays entries in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, because you need to have an entry in the actual dictionary in the Oxford Dictionary of Natural Biography in order to then actually merit an index in the Index of Letters. I'm sure that there are important British Orientalists, British scholars or collectors that are hidden in these vast amount of letters at the Oxford that the Bodleian Collection includes, but yet you will not find because they're not indexed. So I will say quickly something about the methodology and working assumptions of this work. Then I will introduce to you a little bit the biographies of the brothers. Then I will sort of give you, to some degree, an idea of what I rely on in order to identify material, and then I will show you some examples. And in some ways, it will not get as beautiful as it just got. So I thought I wanted to study with the problem that I confront with all of this, because I think we really have to deal with the fact that we have vast amount of material, but we have very poor bibliographic authority over it. So the fact that we lack control of collections, I think, is a starting point. Everything that we do begins with the fact that that somebody will come after us and will be able to find more. So there is always a certain preliminarity about everything. The other thing is also that because collections can be quite large, we do not necessarily have, I think, a good handle on various forms of book production in the Islamic world. So we have, I think, in our research on book production in the Islamic world, we have a focus on workshops and code workshops to some degree, because we have more archival documentation that goes with it. But we know much less about the production of cheap books, and we know much less about the production of what I would call a middling market. So the formal book production that is not made to order but on prospectus, and that is sold or not sold, and that to some degree I think is quite well reflected in collections. And that that of course also gives us a huge problem that how do we actually judge the leftovers that make it from Muslim markets into European collections and survive there, because we don't really have necessarily the context. And the last quote is a reminder of the point that we do this now more than 40 years after Edward Said, still under the problem of treating our now Islamic manuscripts as cultural heritage. Well, I would argue a lot of stuff that emerges if one looks at it from the perspective of actually book trade and book production. In the end, books are just books, and the major point of a book is to convey contents. So I think a lot of aspects that I'm struck with regard to looking at the Usli material is the pragmatic concerns of readers to read certain texts, and that it is so important how the text is transmitted is much less important than the fact that I have access to a copy. And within the history of Persian studies and Iranian studies, the Usli brothers are really important, and they have suffered this interesting fate of being relatively unknown. You can apply for an Usli fellowship at the Warburg Institute. You will have, if you haven't done your own research, you will have no idea who the Uslis are. You're also not sure after which Usli the fellowship is named. It's just called the Usli Fellowship. Something similar happened on the Bodleian website. If you go to the Bodleian website and type Usli, you will get only the reference to fellowships that the Bodleian gave where people work with Usli manuscripts, but you will find no information about them, despite the fact that the Usli manuscripts to some degree are the cornerstone of the Bodleian's Persian manuscript collection. And the other thing is, at the same time, and that made this project to some degree feasible, the textual contents of these manuscripts, even if I don't have archival documentation surrounding them, is really well cataloged. I mean, it's a humbling experience to use Etty's catalog, because the textual quality of the analysis and identification of the text is just superb. And without these large cataloging ventures from the 19th century, what I'm right now doing would be completely impossible. But the other thing is, and I think that's for me, that was one of the starting points, the recognition that the Uslis bring material from particular markets, and this material then becomes incredibly important with regard to modern Persian and Iranian studies, because it is the textual foundation of many of our critical editions. So the question of what did they actually pick up and how, even if we don't reflect it usually when we get this material, is actually shaping in many ways the text that we use for our modern research. And I think this is, again, rather very general, but nonetheless, I think it's important to understand that what happens both in the situation that Sarah just described for Cairo, but also what happens with regard to the Uslis, that we have commercial book trade as a constant feature and that people knew how to sell books. It's not that they suddenly invented how to sell books, so that they were actually well-established traditions of doing it, and it is not something new that emerges in the early modern or modern world. And I think that in this context, the second point that became that I loved in Sarah's presentation, the fact that Muslim communities had foreigners living among them, and these foreigners, of course, also engaged with them in terms of actually buying stuff from them. So it's not only that Europeans must have left book behinds, there was also a long tradition of foreigners buying Muslim books on the Muslim markets. So it was also not that there was something newly invented, it was something that was, I think, quite well established. And I could imagine if you were looking, if you would have comparative analysis of historical European collections of Islamic books, we would find much more traces of the conscious sale of Muslim books to non-Muslim buyers who didn't necessarily know what they were buying. And one could also make the argument about the instances that Sarah just outlined, that this is basically an ancient feature and a permanent feature of the book business. It's the risk of the buyer to see that he buys what that it is actually what the title page says. I mean, it's not the, every book dealer would say, wave their hands off it and say, it's your problem, not mine. And I mean, if you look at a Sotheby's catalog to this day, Sotheby's and Christie's, they all have disclaimers in their catalogs and say, we are not guaranteeing that the content is correct. So I mean, the importance of, this is not a particular feature, I would argue, of the Muslim Christian book trade. The other thing is, and I think that makes people like the Uslis, but also the whole question of how do I look at the book trade important, that this is a in a situation where we are right now, we tend to focus on the collector and the author, but the markets interface tends to be somewhat underappreciated. And I think the importance that struck me with regard to the Uslis is that there is actually agency of the seller. And I personally think, after having looked at this, and I will try to argue for that with the stuff that I show you, is that the dealers have actually agency. So this is not that the Islamic world is on the passive side of this, that there is a very conscious decision at a certain point to sell material to less knowledgeable customers and to preserve certain segments of their stock for people who know what they're buying. So from that perspective, if you want to put it rather provocatively, what flows into the historical European collections is second and third grade material that knowledgeable Muslim dealers would only sell to people who don't know what they're buying, where they would preserve high-end material to their preferred customers. And that's what a dealer is doing to this day and everywhere. It doesn't matter where you go. A good, successful dealer knows to whom he's selling, and he will preserve parts of his segment for customers who sell premium for particularly good stuff, and he will not try to cheat a good customer. If he has a good customer who knows what he's buying, that person will get what it is. But other people who are not particularly knowledgeable will be treated as ignorantly as they are. And I think that also puts the question of moral responsibility. How do I judge this as a commercial transaction? I would basically say it's a commercial transaction. And since we live in the age of liberal markets, I'm not quite sure why we would judge it in the past. To show you the complex situation with regard to where the brothers could buy stuff, I had originally, when I started this project, thought that William was completely dependent on European markets, and Gore would exclusively depend, or would primarily depend on his Indian markets. And one of the fascinating story about this is that you have a little bit of Jane Austen story in that regard, that you have gentry family where only there is money for one military commission for the oldest son. What is important, I think, to understand in the larger context of this, is William is in Paris on the eve of the French Revolution and benefits from the deep tradition of learning in Oriental languages in France at that moment. So he gets his formal introduction to Oriental languages actually in France. And before he goes off after the revolution then to fight in the revolutionary wars, primarily in the Low Countries, but that's how he also gets close to Leiden. And it is enlightened that he then continues with his study of Oto languages and publishes a book that makes him famous, Persian Miscellanies. At the same time, the younger brother is basically shipped off to India and has to make his own way. And I have found by accident a quite moving letter by Goa written to his father when he's on his way to India. He sits in Marseille and waits for a ship and says goodbye. And I do find interesting that he manages to stay for 20 years, but it is not necessarily very commercially successful. Only when he moves to Lucknow does he actually change his fortunes. But he is able, while he was unsuccessfully selling textiles, to actually acquire a library. And we have I have no original letters. Some of the letters between the brothers, which usually took about a year to cross from India back to Britain, where the brothers discuss book acquisitions, it becomes very clear what they are interested in. Is it that makes this story very different from the story that Sarah told, is they are interested in Persian literature. They want to learn Persian. For them, Arabic is a completely secondary, necessary matter, but what they're fascinated by is Persian literature, and they have a quite highly developed sense of that literature comes in different... It comes.
You have 5 minutes.
Literature comes in different qualities, and so they're looking. They want not to buy just a single copy. They actually want to buy multiple copies in order to have good text, and that happens from there. What then happens? They go together to Iran, and then Gore succeeds to be politically make a career. While William never succeeds in any way, and in the end goes to Marseille because he cannot afford to live in Britain, and is publishing quite successfully, but the book that really makes him famous and gives him an afterlife is the Persian Miscellanies. The point that I put in there, and that's another topic about which we don't know enough, is the fact that Gore was incredibly influential by founding the Oriental Translation Society fund. Without the Oriental Translation Fund, we wouldn't have books like Flügel, Kaschel, Sunun. These were also European co-productions. It was organized for the Royal Asiatic Society in London, but scholars may be sitting in Paris or Leipzig. It was also printed in other places on the continent, so it was never a single British operation. It was always collaborative, and Gore was consciously interested and generating printed editions of important Islamic sources for use. I had seen some letters between him and Thomas Phillips about that. People were applying to the OTF to have their manuscripts used as source for practical editions. So the impact of what the Europeans buy in India and bring to Britain actually becomes at that point really important with regard to the quality of our modern texts. And you see William's heirs sell the collection in one go. William missed the point of selling before 1831 for reasons that I haven't seen explained in the research literature. The golden age of British book auctions ends around 1830. And that means when he then finally decides to sell in the early 1830s, he can no longer make the money that he could have made if he had tried to sell 5 years earlier. And then he declines to sell it to part with his collection. Gore, and that makes the situation so messy right now, Gore used his books as liquid assets and sold whenever it was convenient. And afterwards, it creates a second problem. His son is doing the same. His son becomes a professor of church music in Oxford. He's a Christchurch alumni. That means he's also, as an Oxford alumni, an Oxford professor, has a personal connection with the Bodleian Library. So he sells when he needs cash. He sells books that he has held on to. And at the same time, he sells books to fellow Christchurch men like Nathaniel Bland, which is the foundation of the Violence Library. And we have then a network situation where books are dispersed among a group of men who all know what each other have. And there the question of how this material is recorded becomes crucial. Just to give you some idea of the material culture in which this happens, Gore becomes very successful in Lucknow. It also is the foundation of his later service for the British Crown. He builds a hunting lodge for the Nawab. The building didn't last long, but so it's today, I was never there. It's a beautiful garden, which people still can visit. But it used to be, it's an important piece of British colonial architecture that actually is also then in Britain important. And William, on the other hand, is really also an early scholar of Iranian languages. So for some time, he actually uses a Sasanian seal for sealing his letters, and that must be based on original. And I gave the impression to Al-Mutinsa, and she has problems with the legend, but she says it's original. To also give you some idea of the dimensions in which all of this takes place. We're moving between Ireland, Tsarist Russia, but also, I mean, from Lucknow, Calcutta, across in the Eastern world. One of the things that happens, these men never really move into anything North Africa, Egypt, Syria, Turkey. So they really stay on the connection between Britain and India, and then in Tsarist Russia, but it's never going into the core of the Arab world. I wanted to show the Persian miscellanies just because this book becomes a bestseller. It's used for learning Persian and for learning how to read Persian, and as a reminder that printed books are not the stable artifacts we want them to be. Occasionally, the opening title page was, the opening frontispiece was bound wrongly. And then there's another thing about the frontispiece. The frontispiece is also a ghost. I don't know, we have no study of this book, which is another desideratum, I believe, because the Persian text is Jami Yusuf Isolaycha. It's one of the translation exercises that he has in the book. But adding the decorated headband is an invention of the printer. So we have one section of Yosef and Solaycha just put into this, and that's other plates that he inserted. And that is the book that Gore wrote, which was posthumously published, and that raises the whole issue of to which degrees we recreate Middle Eastern genres. That's the Taskiri, based on biographical information in his favorite manuscripts of Persian poems. And again, it becomes a very important book, but it is much less, which is widely used, but it is not as famous as the Persian miscellanies. And this is how they inscribe the books. So we have signatures there. I inserted this one because these are instructions for the binder for reframing, actually, remargining a Quran. And this is the Quran, how it was remargined. Which I was surprised by. You see that the remargins also actually really maintain it as a functional Quran manuscript. William never has printed ex libris of any sort, and you recognize his books usually by the identification of the contents, and occasionally he just inscribes. And the thing that was for me most surprising is that we have to understand that there was an enormous flow of books and exchange of books among scholars already in Europe. So we cannot assume that every book that they have comes directly out of South Asia. And the one thing that interests me right now most, because I sort of stumbled suddenly about it, it is not clear to me to which degree they actually got Ottoman material. They got clearly Ottoman material, because this is a very famous Ottoman manuscript that William Ousli owns, which is, as art historians have used that a lot, it's has a colophon 1453 in Edirne, and that makes it one of the, it goes into Bayezid's library, and it makes it one of the oldest Turkish manuscripts. And he got this in the European trade, I assume, and even though for the longest time it was assumed, and Robinson was the one who put this into circulation, that most of these books were coming from, the assumption was anything pretty beautiful comes from Iran. And that basically the entire valuable collection that they have in terms of particularly Persian illustrated miniature were acquisitions at the Qajar court. And that doesn't really work out, and I stop here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.